Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I've been asked to say a few words this evening, give a talk on Dhamma, some reflections. And it's the winter solstice, shortest day of the year. Also was supposed to be the apocalypse, but I think probably many Americans were kind of waiting in banal expectation for end of the world and thinking, but now that it hasn't happened, kind of ho-hum, get back to our existence. It's our great good fortune to be able to come together here and practice, and many of us probably have a sense that we know we're extremely fortunate to have the opportunity to practice the Dhamma, but chances are we don't know quite how fortunate we are. We don't quite have a sense of since beginningless time and samsara having transmigrated through all the realms of existence and never having achieved liberation from the khandhas. And now being able to come together and practice Dhamma, and in the big scheme of things, in the big scheme of the cycle of transmigration, rebirth, and existence, being able to come extremely close to Nibbana, liberation. And so that just that opportunity is extremely precious and extremely rare in the world. It's not an exaggeration to say that those of us who come to practice the Dhamma and who are able to draw close to Nibbana are the most fortunate people in the world by far. And so it's our great good fortune to be able to come together and practice Anapanasati, watch our breath, contemplate impermanence, very simple practices, but just things that are leading to peace, leading to happiness, leading to enlightenment. It's a great good fortune. It's as if we've been just handed some sort of wish-granting gem that can just fulfill any of our wishes. And also to put things in perspective, it's like if we were having drawn close to this shot at enlightenment, then if we're to attain it, it would be like, and we might have kind of a sense of, yeah, liberation would be good, it'd be nice, it'd be, but we don't quite have a sense that if we're to attain liberation, then the heart has attained its sort of eternal wish since beginningless time. Probably don't quite have that sense, but that's the perspective of the Buddha, is that if we're able to realize the Four Noble Truths, then yeah, that's something that the heart has been wishing and yearning for since beginningless time, but hasn't yet realized. And so it's like having a wish-granting gem. It's as if we've just been handed this gem, and all we have to do is practice some not so difficult instructions. And in the big scheme of things, not so difficult. Just have to practice the Eightfold Path. And then we say, haven't wasted our life, we've made use of that wish-granting gem. But conversely, if we decide, Yeah, well, I can't attain enlightenment. I don't have enough merit. I'm gonna throw in the towel and, stop practicing. Then it's like taking that wish-granting gem and just tossing it away, having been handed that precious jewel. Then, to what greater pity to just toss it away? And so we all have this sort of precious gem, this refuge that we've come to, and to make use of it. And we're allowed to make use of it. It's just having to raise up a mental intention, a desire to train. And again, these having come to this lifestyle and these precepts and the rules that we're holding, whether it's the 227 or the 8 precepts or the 10 precepts, 8 precepts, 5 precepts, whatever precepts we're holding, and taking those as our foundation, and then developing the long-enduring mind, so we have a long-term perspective in our practice, and then, taking on the practice, sitting and walking meditation, service, cultivating parami, dana parami, generosity, kanti parami, patience. Patient endurance in Thai, otton, having to develop these virtues as foundations in the Noble Eightfold Path, mindfulness. And also just cultivating an honesty with oneself. We all have defilements that we're trying to eradicate, get perspective around. Realize, have realization around, and it's better to be honest with oneself about the defilements one has rather than deny that one has them. And so, cultivating kind of an inner honesty, satcha parami, inner honesty in oneself. Long enduring mind, adhitana parami, just determining to stick with it come what may. Sila parami, precepts. Nekama parami, that's renunciation. So these things are all kind of foundations, bolstering up the practice, but really what it comes back to is these simple practices, walking meditation, sitting meditation, anapanasati, for those of us using a mantra, buddho, or a mantra I was playing around with recently, nippon, nippon. It's kind of fun. Just making that determination, making that strong resolution to just keep the practice going, come what may. Walking meditation is a good one. Have you ever done walking meditation? Have you ever used your Jhongrum path before? What was it like? What was walking meditation like? Have you ever gone back to your kuti after the meal and walked meditation for 4 hours? And what was it like? Have you ever taken your sitting cloth and decided, I'm going to go out to Cool Oaks and meditate at the foot of a tree? We have this forest here, 250 acres, and how many of us have actually made use of it? Have we ever gone out to Cool Oaks and sat meditation at the foot of a tree for 2 hours? Or next sunny day, try it out. I might find it's quite a fruitful practice if you try it out. Find a secluded tree, find some place off of the trail. You're going to bring a blanket and a sitting cloth and a jug of water. Spend the afternoon at the foot of a tree. See what it's like. We're allowed to practice this way. We're allowed to do it. But it's just internalizing this mental determination to practice in that way. Even though it's 2012 modern times and 2,555 years since the time of the Buddha, we're allowed to practice like in the time of the Buddha. We have the facilities, we have the forest, we have the dwelling places. So, but it's just a matter of, that willingness to cultivate ourselves in that way, and an inner determination to train the mind using these practices laid out by the Buddha. When the defilements come up, have we been applying the antidotes? If we think about the future, have we been applying the death contemplation? That's the practice. These are the practices the Buddha gave us to be applied. Just the willingness to put forth the mental effort that's needed. Are we depressed? Are we happy? How are we doing? If we're depressed, and why is it? There's always, you know, the cause of depression is, it may have a physical basis if it's clinical depression, but if it's just, a lot of the time it's thinking about oneself, like Ajahn Sumedho. Whenever I think about myself, I get depressed. And that's Ajahn Sumedho. He's kind of, doesn't have much to be depressed about. Thinking about oneself, trying to do things for oneself, but also mental, certain hindrances, defilements come up, and we need to be applying the antidotes. Ajahn Kurnadamo gave a reflection the other day that we have to practice these too, and so that we can bring them up, so we have a sort of a tool bag of antidotes, you know, when we have to be cultivating metta, even when we're not angry, so that when we do get angry or irritated, then the metta is there, we can tap into it. You know, we do have to do the death contemplation so that when we start incessantly planning or thinking about the future, then we can bring it up and it can be an antidote for that. And so, or we do need to cultivate the anapanasati and just that mindfulness of breathing and calming the body so that when the mind is extra restless, you know, the mind goes up and down, these hindrances are always going to arise. And so we have that anapanasati, we've been cultivating it. And so, yeah, we can bring it up and apply it. And this can happen any time of the day. It doesn't just need to be when we're sitting in meditation. The walking meditation, the Kruba Ajahn's love to teach about this, is great for being just applying mindfulness in our daily life, whatever we're doing, whether we're working or, yeah, whatever we're doing. And so the Buddha also praised walking meditation as being good for the digestion, good for the composition. We can, if we're going to go tudong, we can walk for long distances without getting tired, but also any samadhi, any concentration we get that from the practice of walking meditation lasts for a long time, lasts longer than sitting meditation. But it also bleed into the sitting meditation and bolster it up. In walking meditation, drowsiness is going to tend to not come up, so we're cultivating the walking meditation, and the mind can get have the opportunity to get bright and extremely bright, radiant. Ajahn Mahabua spoke in praise of walking meditation, and he had walking meditation, his mind was getting extremely bright, concentrated, unbelievably clear and pure and bright during the walking meditation. And so that can happen. The Buddha also spoke in praise of service to the Sangha, and so that's another sort of aspect of cultivation, especially here at Abhayagiri. We've got the work period, and that's also just prime time for cultivating barami, Kanti barami, Dana barami, just prime time. There's a sutta where Ananda is giving a lot of service, and Mahakasapa, you know, also, Ananda's not yet an arhat in the sutta, but Mahakasapa is enlightened and, you know, admonishes Ananda for receiving lay people all day long. He's also doing services for the Buddha and doing all sorts of service around the monastery. He's not meditating at all. And but then the Buddha sort of tells Mahakasapa, don't admonish Ananda. He's cultivating great merit. He's one who has great merit. Merit is a synonym for happiness. Merit is happiness. Punya in Pali, boon in Thai. Boon is happiness. But then Ananda shows his humility by then bowing to Mahakasapa and thanking him for pointing this out to him. So there's all these different aspects of practice. But also in the Vinaya, the allocation of dwelling places. First pick of dwellings goes to those who give great service to the Sangha. And then, you know, those who give great service to the Sangha according to seniority. Second pick goes to those who can chant the Padimokkha. And then that goes by seniority of Padimokkha chanters. And then finally, then the dwellings go by seniority after that, according to the Vinaya. So it's interesting that the Buddha organized these things in this way, recognizing service. So great service is a way of cultivation, work for the Sangha, but it also has to be held in the right way. So if we're just proliferating a lot, or, you know, getting kind of, the mind is going a bit dark, why do I have to do all this service? Why doesn't anybody else help out? It's not being held in the wrong way, and probably best to back off if that's the case. But if we're holding service in the way of practice, in the way of patipat, then that's a great thing, precious. In the way of cultivating parami. And a lot of times, people who are giving great service, you see their mind is bright and happy. Yeah, so just these, just coming back to simple practices to make good use of the opportunity that we've achieved here. And so many times, we can't really see the causes of why we have this great opportunity this time in history. It's not a time of war, a time of famine. We've got great teachers around. We've got good facilities, opportunity to make use of them to practice. And so we can't see our past lives, but we all must have cultivated incredible virtues to be able to come together in this way. One thing that's important that the Buddha talked about in mundane right view is a belief or a faith in karma and rebirth, and also just a basic faith in cause and effect. And we haven't yet realized it for ourselves, but we're the owners of our karma, heirs to our karma, born of our karma. Everything karma is holding us up, abide supported by our karma. And so there is karma and rebirth. And we have been migrating through all these rebirths and all these different realms since beginningless time in samsara. But we might think, no, there's not karma and rebirth. That's just sort of the Buddha speaking in metaphors. Well, we think there's not rebirth because I would remember my past lives. We would remember it, but we can barely remember what happened last month. So it's not surprising that we can't remember our past lives. Also, supposedly, the process of birth is so utterly traumatic that the mind sets up a wall. And it takes a lot of practice to get over that wall and see what happened before our birth. I'd like to talk a little bit about mindfulness of breathing and just kind of how it ties in with the Marananusati, or the death contemplation, and why this is kind of a good thing, and how we always bring the practice back to now and having to do it now, and bringing up the effort to sort of cultivate these antidotes to the hindrances, because it it kind of almost, we almost have to trick ourselves into practicing. And really, if we don't cultivate these antidotes, there's really not that much time to cultivate. It seems like there's a lot of time when we're young, but before we know it, we start growing older, and before we know it, we're sick, unable to practice, and dying. And the Dhamma is the one thing that's going to help us. And so we really have to convince ourselves to be practicing in this moment, and not just when we're sitting or walking meditation, but any moment, really, really bringing up that mental effort, and that's going to be what really makes the mind bright. So with Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, it's good to remember that, say, even though we can't see other realms of existence, for example, lower realms, upper realms, or we can't know what death is like, it's actually, these things, they seem like they're far away, but they're very, very close, because the only thing that separates us from, say, another realm of existence or the next life is the fact that we can still breathe in and out. And so when the day comes when we breathe out and we don't breathe in, then we take rebirth in another realm of existence and possibly the lower realms. We can't be sure. And if we take rebirth in a, say, an animal, as an animal, it's going to be very hard to be reborn as a human being again. So it's good to relate to this human life as if it's our one chance. And so the only thing between us and the end of this life is the fact that we can still draw breath. And so with Anapanasati, that reflection can kind of sort of help us focus on the breathing, breathing in, breathing out, and calming the body. Thoughts of the future, thoughts of the past coming up, thoughts of the future, planning, work, etc. Yeah, just bringing up, well, the future is completely uncertain. Right here is the breath that can be set aside for the time being. First and foremost, as cultivators, practitioners, our duty is to make the mind clean and bright. And so we're using the mindfulness of breathing, just breathing in and breathing out in a natural way, and letting the mind settle. There's going to be all sorts of thoughts coming up, but that's okay. They're not self. Thoughts, worries, these are all not self. So just allowing these things to just kind of swirl around, and they're going to follow their own nature. But with time, they'll kind of settle down. Mind will get bright, clean, spacious. Body can start to be calm. And so this is why we meditate. This calm and happiness, it can give us, it can be sort of a reassuring occurrence that allows us to keep practicing. And then when the mind is calm, the body's calm, hindrances may be arising, passing away. Maybe some sort of irritation from the past comes up. Or the mind is just restless and thoughts are sort of swirling around, but not any real coherent story. We can start to bring up various reflections that help to calm the mind further. So we might reflect like, oh, what's desire doing these days? You know, what is the desire mind kind of seeking these days? You know, why is that? You know, what story is it telling me? What am I going to get from if I fulfill that desire? Ajahn Chah talked about this quite a bit, just having these conversations with himself, like, yeah, what's that desire? Just questioning. The way of a practitioner is just to be always questioning oneself. Is that really the case? Not sure. Maybe that's not the case. Someone asked Ajahn Chah once, what's the quickest way to enlightenment? He said, just point your finger right at your own mind and just say, liar. Just everything that comes up, just you're lying, every desire. Just liar, you're lying, it's a trick. The mind is tricking us, the mind is very tricky. Yeah, he's only kind of, he's not really joking there. You can kind of see that, yeah, that's the sort of lie of desire, or the lie of anger, or irritation, or whatever. Choose your favorite defilement. And then coming back to Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And so with the precepts that we're following and the mindfulness of breathing, this is building an extremely strong foundation for practice. And slowly wisdom will start to come from that, bleed into our daily life. The Dhamma will get quicker and quicker. You know, it's like, why do I always have to be first at the breakfast tray? So that's the Dhamma coming in, kind of like, you know, maybe I can wait till someone else gets their donut first and I don't have to rush in and sort of, you know, grab it right away. You know, what's that restlessness in the mind? What's that desire? Can I wait 3 minutes? Can I wait 5 minutes? What if somebody takes some food I want? What if the monk in front of me takes the last wonton that I had my eye on? You know, what happens? Rage? Irritation? Murderous intent. But yeah, just to... So the Dhamma is that which in us is just kind of questioning, well, you know, may he be happy that... May this be an act of generosity. But it's going to be hard to bring the Dhamma up in these ways if we don't have a strong foundation and just really, yeah, sitting and walking meditation, mindfulness of breathing, trying to see how calm and peaceful we can get. Not in a spaced out way, but in a bright, mindful way. Calm yet alert. And cultivating this way, we can difficulties that inevitably arise. Mara doesn't like it when we start to question the defilements. So difficulties inevitably arise, obstacles can be small obstacles, big obstacles. We can lose the plot. We might, you know, lose the practice for periods of time. That's okay. As long as we're keeping our precepts, pick ourselves back up. Ajahn Mahabhua said that the practice of Dhamma is a lot like you're kind of walking forward and then you just stumble and you're kind of crawling for a while and then Mara kind of kicks you down and you're on your stomach and you're kind of crawling and then you get up and you run for a little bit, you're inspired for a little bit, you're running and then you just fall down again. And so, but we just have to find ways, use our ingenuity, intelligence, just find ways to keep moving forward. Another point that could be made about Dhamma practice, I think, is that understanding Dhamma and understanding the Buddha's teachings has a lot to do with understanding principle. And the suttas, the Vinaya, they're like a map. All the teachings of the Buddha are like a map. And when we follow them, it's kind of like driving somewhere or walking somewhere on the journey. And so the map is gonna kind of tell us how to get there. And we can have memorized the instructions and be willing to follow them very carefully. Let's say we want to go to Pacific Hermitage. We want to drive from here to Washington. And so we have the map, and the map is, yeah, it tells us exactly how to get there. But when we drive there, it's a completely different experience than looking at the map. You know, there's the redwoods and the mountains and the different gorges and everything that occurs along the way that's not included in the map. And I think the Buddhist teachings are very much like that, and the practice is very much like actually driving to Pacific Hermitage. And so what the map's not going to tell us is there's a tree across the road. You know, what are we going to do? What, the map doesn't say there was a tree across the road here. What do we do? And so understanding principle, we have to, you know, come up with ways to deal with things that aren't on the map. So the tree is across the road, and like maybe we search off the side of the road. Is there a dirt road? Is there an alternate route? Is there some way we can cut the tree apart, move it? Can we get a chain around the tree and pull it with our car? Maybe we can do that. So there's no complete instruction manual for the practice, and it's going to be necessary to understand principle. And to do that, we have to understand, you know, what are we doing here, and what is our aim? The work period can kind of teach us that too. Like we were oiling tools the other day, and Taylor was doing the oil. Tanti Tapanyo was kind of washing the tools off. We had kind of an assembly line going. And so I gave Taylor, yeah, basic instructions on how to oil the tools. You know, you spray the WD-40 on, leave it for a minute, and then wipe it off. And then he kind of figured out on his own, hey, if the tool's not rusty, you can wipe it off right away. If there's more rust, you can leave it on up to 5 minutes. And I was really happy to see that, because that's a perfect illustration of understanding principle. It's like, there's no need to give instructions that detailed. Like, you know, at a certain point, it's too much instruction. And so, a lot of things in our life are like that, where we just have to understand the principle, understand what is our aim, what is our goal, and then trying to move in that direction. So I don't have too much to say. These are just some rambling thoughts and reflections on the eve of the apocalypse. So I'll leave it for that.